Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at DecodingTV.com. Become a paid member. Get access to ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, as well as bonus episodes. Thanks to everyone at DecodingTV.com who makes this podcast possible.
Otis Heiss didn't survive Annie. She wasn't even born when he was injured.
She's been hiding in those caves forever. And before she was born, after we all die, time is a flat circle, and we are all stuck in it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I'm David Chen. Joining me, as always, Patrick Klepek. How's it going today?
I'm currently Googling, like, what are estimates to put a hatch in the bottom of my house? If anyone's got any feedback, please feel free to write in and let me know how much that might cost.
Of course, that's a vague and oblique reference to the fact that today on the podcast, we're going to be reviewing, discussing, recapping in detail the season finale of True Detective Night Country. We'll be discussing all of the discourse that's been going around it, and then also just talking about what happened in the episode. It's going to be an old school recap episode for the finale, so stick around. That's going to be a fun chat. Before that, we're going to talk about Jon Stewart's return to The Daily Show and talk about what our personal reactions to that have been. So lots to discuss. You can find more episodes of the show at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com and find us across all platforms at decodingtv. I want to mention, if you want to send us some questions, we're going to try to do a bonus mailbag episode this week. Going to try to get back in the swing of doing some bonus episodes and kind of figuring out what the format of those is going to be. Send us your questions at decodingtv@gmail.com. Give us a comment over at decodingtv.com. Either way is a good way to get a question into us. We'd love to hear your questions. What's on your mind? What are you watching? What's your TV recommendations? What are things you think we should check out? Let us know your questions and thoughts at decodingtv@gmail.com. While I'm on the topic of announcements, I want to mention next week's episode is going to be a little bit late. We typically record these episodes on Tuesday mornings, but Constellation is going to be debuting on Apple TV Plus on Wednesday, February 21st. And then Shogun, a new series on FX/Hulu, is going to be debuting on February 27th. And we thought about, like, hey, we want to cover both of these shows, at least the beginnings of both of these shows. Our Tuesday recording time doesn't really make that easy to do. So we're going to record on Wednesday next week. The episodes will come out a little bit later than usual next week. Hopefully you'll stick with us. But we plan to cover, for next week, the first three episodes of Constellation on Apple TV Plus, and the first two episodes of Shogun on FX and Hulu. So tune in and watch those shows. Come join us for the recap and review. Should be a fun time. So just wanted to get those announcements out of the way. Before we get to our opening topic, Patrick Klepek, let's talk about Jon Stewart's return to The Daily Show. Now, we discussed this a couple weeks ago. Jon Stewart's coming back. He's hosting on Monday nights. And he is also executive producing the rest of the week and kind of being a creative force in the show through this year's election. His return drew a lot of eyeballs. The episode had some decent ratings. The clip from the episode of his opening bit had over 8 million views on YouTube. My question for you, Patrick Klepek, overall, what did you think of Jon Stewart's return to this hallowed institution on Comedy Central?
I think Jon Stewart's return to The Daily Show is an interesting cultural, political litmus test for sort of like where you're at as a person. Watching the reactions to Stewart in which, so we've spent the last decade reckoning with culturally that Jon Stewart was kind of a both sides squish. And then he comes back and a bunch of supposed leftists don't like him. Where does that leave us as a country? Where does like people who are politically aligned, especially on the left? I thought it was a good, but not great, but culturally fascinating return. It was well worth watching, I think, because of the cultural moment, more so than Jon Stewart making me feel like safe and relieving my anxiety about what's to come, especially this year. But I think especially as reflective of our current politics, I thought it was a fascinating moment that I'll be curious if it continues to have that sort of resonance going forward, or was this like the pilot, like the return of Stewart to this chair, the moment where a lot of people experience some form of anxiety or catharsis?
Well, I'm struck by how very frequently during these opening news segments, Patrick, you and I agree 100%, which often doesn't happen when we talk about shows like Twisted Metal.
Let that one go. Or, 5 years later, right? Dave's like, look, I pitched this podcast to you and you pitched me Twisted Metal.
Well, hey, you know, I got the Continental in with you as well. So, you know, we both got one in on the Peacock original series front. But I think that how much you like Jon Stewart's return, and in particular that opening episode, can be best thought of or perceived through the lens of how much do you like, how important of an issue do you think Joe Biden's age is to the future of the American Republic? Like, whatever your answer is for that question, that will address, I think, whether you appreciated Jon Stewart coming back and spending a significant portion of his time discussing Joe Biden's age and the concerns around it. Here's a clip from the episode.
The Biden-Harris campaign joined TikTok over the weekend. The first video was released during the Super Bowl, and it shows President Biden answering questions related to the big game.
Game or halftime show?
Game.
Jason Kelce or Travis Kelce?
Mama Kelce. I understand she makes great chocolate chip cookies. Fire everyone. Everyone. How do you go on TikTok and end up looking older?
That was a clip from Jon Stewart's first episode back at The Daily Show. And I will say this about Jon Stewart. I don't think he's lost a step in terms of his energy and in terms of how he can work the crowd and basically just be a force and a presence behind the desk. Like, I think if you enjoyed him back then, when he was still on The Daily Show, I honestly think, and by the way, none of your political opinions or perception of the world has changed in the 9 years since, then I think you will enjoy him now. Like, that's how I feel about it. But I also think that one of the reasons this appearance, this return, has created so much discourse and dialogue is because there's a lot of people, myself included, that wonder if this is the voice we need right now. And specifically, the questions he's asking are the ones that are most important to ask right now. In fact, he seemed to actually understand this as a criticism and acknowledged it directly on the air when his correspondent, Jordan Klepper, who's hosting the rest of the week, said this in a segment that they did in banter on the show.
Biting, John, biting. You must be so proud of yourself with all these little satirical bits exposing the absurdities of our political process.
Well, I mean, it was fun. We had a fun day. We had fun making this stuff up.
Oh, I bet it was. Did you save democracy yet?
No, I didn't.
Did you? Your 90s brand of snark and both-siderism. Oh, George Bush is dumb. Al Gore's so boring. Wow, searing, John.
I wasn't really trying to save democracy. I was just trying to...
All you do is brainwash voters into accepting a corrosive status quo when they could be out marching in the streets to effect change. Frankly, you disgust me.
Shortly after that, of course, Jordan Klepper realizes that he's going to be hosting the rest of the week and all is well. But Jon Stewart does seem to be hearing the criticism. He also addressed it on the second episode, which I'll discuss in a little bit. But I think that it all comes down to whether you think, you know, the stuff that Jon Stewart's trying to talk about, which is in this case, Joe Biden's age, is one of the most important questions we need to be talking about right now. He certainly seems to think it is. I don't think it's as important as other issues. It's notable, I think, in the first two episodes, he really hasn't addressed Trump directly in his opening monologues. He's talked about it during the interviews a little bit. But I do think that is worth noting as well, because Trump has said some really upsetting things about how he would rule in his second term that Jon Stewart hasn't touched on. Now, still has time, but yeah. So those are my overall thoughts. Patrick Klepek, any reaction to anything I said?
Well, I would say I think there's a little more nuance to what Stewart was doing. I don't think it's exactly a return to just poking, like saying that both sides are equal. I think in the statement itself and the segment itself, he's actually pretty specific in pointing out, sure, if the Democrats put out a cardboard box that said politician A, I'm probably voting for politician A this fall, given what's on, like what's at stake, as you point out rightly, that the terror and what would happen to many great number of people I care about if Trump was elected a second time is very real. And yet I'm allowed to ask, hey, maybe I could vote for something more than a cardboard box. And I don't think that's both sides of them. I think that is certainly Stewart is guilty of saying both sides are bad and equal. I don't think that's what was happening here. I think the nuance there is asking for a better Democratic Party if you're going to stamp your vote, and a little bit of pushing back on the blue no matter who kind of rhetoric that sometimes dominates these elections that feel as though the entire world is at stake. And that is not to diminish anything that's going to be at stake this fall. But I don't think it was as simple as just saying bringing up Joe Biden's age is inherently saying Trump and Biden are equal. And so,
yeah, first of all, I apologize if that's what I said.
I feel the reaction to the show itself. I felt like that was a lot of the irritation to Stewart.
A lot of the criticism was, oh, he's playing both sides. But that's not what I said. Like, what I said was, do you think that is the most important pressing issue that we have right now? And I personally don't believe it is. I think we have other more pressing issues.
I think it's got to start somewhere. It's like, I feel like part of this is, if I end up watching more of the show or kind of, you know, seeing which segments kind of like lift out in the weeks ahead, I'm more inclined to see what is Stewart's body of work, because this is a show that he's going to be doing weekly, used to do daily. And part of how you establish your hierarchy of priorities is over the long term. It's going to be a long goddamn year as we march towards the election. And so I think I'm more inclined to give Stewart a bit of a pass, because I don't necessarily know what I need right out of the gate is to be told the ways that Trump is bad necessarily. I don't know that I need that from Jon Stewart, I guess is what I'm saying. And so I'm more inclined to see, where does he choose to spend his time going forward, and how much has he really changed? It's very easy to do a segment that pokes fun at the easiest possible critique that has been established about Jon Stewart and his time post Daily Show. It's much harder to know how will that actually resonate in his work going forward. What does he prioritize as segments going forward? And I think it's maybe a little too early to make that determination.
Here's where I don't agree. I don't think it's too early to make that determination, because he deliberately chose to, he knew that this would be the time when he would possibly, if not be at his height, one of his peaks of most interest. And this was the segment that he chose to open with. You know, like, I don't, yes, there is something to be said about judging someone by their whole work, but he knew, like, this is, like, a lot of people will be judging him on this, and then we'll decide to come back based on this. And I will say I am disappointed that this is kind of how he chose to spend his time. And in addition to just the topic focus, I think he continues to kind of have this condescending detachment towards people that might think he could use his time in better or more productive ways, or asking different, more urgent questions. That sort of I'm just a comedian. I'm not trying to save democracy. You know, why are you asking me to do anything that might make the world a better place? That tone continues in the show, and it's equally tiresome as it was back then. So it sounds like I'm like significantly more negative on this appearance than you are. And
I
guess
my expectations just weren't. I don't know what people were. I think, okay, if I back up a little bit, I think ascribing a malaise amongst folks' approach to politics in the 2000s, mm-hmm. Obama era especially, as being Jon Stewart,
Jon Stewart's fault is
putting far too much on one individual cable channel news station's shoulders when it is more representative of, you know, a broader populist miscalculation that really didn't start to course correct until someone like Trump came along and put into stark reality like what the stakes actually are. And so Stewart is a convenient vehicle, and he represents that malaise and that kind of lazy liberalism that certainly defined a lot of the Obama era for sure. I'm certainly guilty of participating in myself. But I don't know that it necessarily like that Stewart was going to solve that either. And so I guess for me, that's why I find the reaction to Stewart and people's own shifting political positions to be more interesting than what Stewart does or doesn't do, because ultimately I don't think Stewart will have any meaningful impact on votes at the end of the year, which doesn't mean he should waste the platform. It's still a platform.
Right.
I guess for me, I'm just, I don't know what that platform means quite yet. And I'll be curious to see like what he chooses to shine a spotlight on. Going to Tucker Carlson in the second episode is a very convenient, easy bait. Right. That's, I mean, how many segments has he done on Tucker Carlson over the course of his career?
Right. I think that's all accurate, Patrick Lepik, what you said. And there are people who say that Jon Stewart is responsible for, you know, the lack of civic engagement amongst a significant group of liberals. And I would agree that I don't know that he's responsible. He might be emblematic of it. You know, he might represent it in some way.
I think that's more accurate,
yes. Right, but I don't think he's responsible for it. By the way, I've been kind of alluding vaguely to what some of the issues that I think are more important. Google the phrase Trump's second term. If you are curious, like all the things that Trump said he is going to do if he is elected president for the second term. And those are the things that I'm talking about that I think actually require more attention. Patrick Klepek, I think that you know, your expectations were set in the correct place for this. I think I was just wondering that maybe Jon Stewart would be able to show us something like a different, perhaps more focused or harder edge sensibility in his second stint in the chair. And I'm disappointed that he has not been. He doesn't seem to be interested in doing that.
I'm far more disappointed in Stephen Colbert than I'll ever be in Jon Stewart. I thought Colbert was smarter, more biting, more insightful. And look, I'm not going to knock somebody that wants to do a different type of job, but the way Colbert has just laxed into like a late night show, Tom Hanks, is one of the more disappointing falls for political. Like satirical comedian. I held Colbert in much higher esteem than I ever did Stewart. And the way that Colbert has fallen, that will hurt my soul more than whatever Stewart does. And maybe that has more to do. Maybe that is ultimately like what I'm getting at here is like, I don't think that has hurt me in the last 10 years more than Stewart not quite getting.
Like felt there was more potential for Colbert to do something really interesting and meaningful. And he has chosen a career path that, while it might be very personally fulfilling and financially fulfilling for him, doesn't do that.
No, and it makes me happy that someone like John Oliver exists, because I think John Oliver is, in many ways, represents an evolved version of Stewart and Colbert's work. It understands the modern internet, and it's like it's very deep. It's deeply informative. It's still really funny, and the two of them just like one goes to a late night show, one returns to an aging daily news, you know what I mean? It's a little bit of a bummer that both of them seem to have not found ways to continue some of their strongest approaches to the work in a format that makes sense like this century, whereas Oliver seems to have figured that part out.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair, Patrick Lepik. You're saying, you know, your expectations for the upper bound of what Jon Stewart could have accomplished were not particularly high to begin with, and so his return here doesn't disappoint you that much. Or really at all, it sounds like.
I did chuckle, though. Like, I didn't have a bad... I have not had a bad time watching the couple of episodes.
I will say,
I enjoyed watching his... No offense to Klepper, like, he's fine, but, it was more of a chore to get through to his episode than it was to get through Stewart's, I'll say.
I think he's a perfectly adequate kind of...
Totally.
Successor, if that's even what he is, right, to Stewart. He has the kind of honestly almost like a similar hairstyle. He has the similar mannerisms. Like, I think he's a perfectly adequate Jon Stewart substitute. And also, like, say what you will about Klepper, he actually gets out there. You know, he's out there.
Oh, it's still, his strongest stuff. Like, in the studio, I'm falling asleep. But when he's out there talking to people where he has to do a lot of improv, I think that's where he's at his real strength.
I do think, you know, I have this feeling when I'm watching it there is this kind of, I feel like those segments, while they are like really comedically interesting at times and give you a glimpse of people you might not otherwise interact with, there is this kind of notion that creeps in when I'm watching this show of like, what is the purpose of, like, a lot of the show is just pointing and laughing, you know? And that was very enjoyable and satisfying maybe when I was in college. But it holds less interest for me these days, you know?
It really is the old Daily Show ethos, but like done in field segment. It's like, hey, I'm smarter than these people.
Look at these
dumb people who are getting suckered into buying Trump debit cards that don't have any cash on them. It's like, okay, do I laugh in the segment? Yeah, I'm shallow. Like, I will laugh at that. It's funny. But the moment you have any distance from it, I think you end up feeling pretty empty because it doesn't tell me anything about this person, this movement. I think it's very much in line with the old Daily Show ethos. In a way that is equally disappointing.
It's the political equivalent of junk food. You know, it's like, hey, that feels good going down, but like at the end, it leaves me empty. I'm no better a person than I was when I went into this.
Junk food can be okay. It's okay to just have something that goes through your brain and you don't like. It's all like, life is hard, and sometimes it's okay to have, like, I feel like sometimes, you know, it's, everyone has their version of that. And if the Daily Show or those segments are yours, Godspeed. Like, you know, like, everyone's got their version of something like that. But I think where you and I are landing on this is, I think the ratio is off on, like, having moments like that that are pure just sort of pointing a finger and laughing at something that feels objectively hypocritically stupid, but then also some manner of substance to go along with it.
And to be fair, they do bring on guests every night, and some of the guests are really, you know, they're authors who have thought deeply about the political issues of our day, and they do engage in those things. But I do think it makes for an unwieldy marriage of these two segments where, like, in one you're trying to be thoughtful and have this discourse, and the other there's this, again, all the issues we've discussed, this tone of detachment and condescension and, you know, and also kind of, I certainly don't think he like takes the criticism. Is seriously the right word? I mean, here's what he said in episode 2 about all the reactions to his first episode.
But I guess, as the famous saying goes, democracy dies in discussion. But look, I have sinned against you. I'm sorry. It was never my intention to say out loud what I saw with my eyes and then brain. I can do better.
I certainly don't think he's going to change his approach, you know, based off of that. So.
No, that is, you know, it's, that's a glib way of responding to, like, even if I disagree with the criticism of Stewart that arrives at that glib response he provides, all you're doing is just reaffirming the soft criticism of him in the first place. Like if there was, you know, a joke or even a glib response tied up in like, hey, I actually think this is healthy for like the Democratic Party to reckon with, like, this is how we've arrived and what we should be thinking about. Like, again, there's like a way of talking through that and even doing so humorously. But like, that's the bad Jon Stewart. Like, that's the one that makes me wonder, did you put that segment in with Klepper where you're talking about like, I understand how people talked about me. Like, did you? Like, do you like, did you? And I, you know, I don't know that you can definitively say that, because the ultimately the way that that's going to manifest is in the work as opposed to a scripted comedic bit between one of the other hosts of the show. And I think moments like that, which are much less likely to be scripted and much more likely to be improvising, is probably truer to the soul of Jon Stewart than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think you're also right about it's okay to want the junk food. But also I think it's important to know that it's junk food, you know, mm-hmm. like to understand the weaknesses of the food that you're, or the media that you're consuming, and to be like, hey, okay, that made me feel good for a little bit. Now, if I actually want the world to change, I need to actually do some work, you know, or not just kind of laugh at all the problems around me. So, end of the day, I think Jon Stewart delivered on what he delivered back in the day for sure. And for me personally, it's just not what I'm interested in anymore. But if it is something you're still interested in, I think that's completely fine. But let's just be realistic about what that actually is. You know, does that sound fair, Patrick Klepek?
I agree.
All right. Well, those are some thoughts on the return of Jon Stewart to The Daily Show.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
And I want to remind folks that next week we'll be covering Shogun and Constellation, the first few episodes of each that'll be available on Apple TV Plus and Hulu. So tune in for those recaps and reviews right here on Decoding TV. But why don't we get to our conversation about True Detective Night Country?
Can I ask you a favor? Please.
She's awake. She's awake.
You should never have touched this case.
There is something out there calling me.
All right, let's talk about the finale of True Detective Night Country. Now, before we talk about the finale of True Detective Night Country, we got to talk. So no spoilers yet. We're going to talk about a lot of the stuff and dialogue around True Detective Night Country. Stuff that's happened just in the last 48 hours or so as we're recording this. Now, on this podcast, Decoding TV, we've talked about how there's been a lot of online criticism of True Detective Night Country. I have seen this criticism from a variety of different sources, like not just online 4chan trolls who hate that there's two women woking up their True Detective series. I've seen it from people who are legit TV critics and cultural critics that I respect who don't like the new season of True Detective. At the same time that I've seen that, also, by the way, I should note that one of the most upsetting things I saw was Alan Sepinwall giving a positive review to True Detective Night Country. Now, I will not comment on my own thoughts on the finale, but I'll just say then people attacking Alan Sepinwall for liking it, criticizing Alan Sepinwall for saying like, oh, well, Alan doesn't know what he's talking about anymore. And my reaction to those people is, how dare you? Alan Sepinwall is one of the patron saints of TV reviews and recaps.
Agreed.
And just because he liked True Detective Night Country does not invalidate his current opinions on things. But that was remarkable. Was like people going after Alan Sepinwall. I'm like, dude, this is a universally beloved television critic. How dare you? Okay. Anyway, that's one strain of stuff that I saw happening. We should also point out, Patrick Klepek, that True Detective Night Country, the season finale, had more viewers than any other episode of True Detective in the history of HBO and True Detective. 3.2 million viewers across HBO and Max the One to Watch for HBO. 57% higher than the premiere episode, which indicates, that's a really strong sign. That indicates people saw the show, they told others about the show,
bandwagon
and other people
effect.
Started watching the show. Yeah, yeah. So that is the most, like, that should overshadow anything else we talk about, because regardless of all of our dialogue here, the show was a huge hit. Like, for Max the One to Watch for HBO, it's the most successful True Detective season yet. A lot of people, a lot of critics loved it, a lot of people watching it loved it, and the numbers reflect that. So it's important to remind ourselves, that, as I'm doing right now, that online is not real life. The numbers bear out that this show was a big success. But that's not what Nick Pizzolatto seems to think, Patrick Klepek.
Ugh. Okay. Proceed.
Nick Pizzolatto decided to, who, by the way, I'm assuming at least partially financially benefits from True Detective succeeding in some
way. I don't know how the money works, but I mean, he's listed as an executive producer. McConaughey is listed as an executive producer. Harrelson's listed as an executive producer. I assume some amount of money go, like, there's a reason you want that credit, because whether you're involved or not, I imagine some sort of money.
Well, let's put that aside. Maybe they might not be getting compensated for that at all. Let's say True Detective Night Country reinvigorated. There are more people that now have watched a True Detective season than have ever done so before in the past. And maybe they're going to buy that Blu-ray box set now. You know, maybe they'll buy that digital box set and they'll definitely get money from that. So anyway, Nick Pizzolatto decided to use his time this week when he should have been celebrating the show that he spawned, notching its greatest ratings ever, reposting on Instagram people who hated True Detective Night Country.
Zero subtlety whatsoever. We vaulted on the last time we talked about this. He's in the comments, and it's like, all right, he's liking, like, all right.
Right.
Sometimes people, even when they're doing disgusting things, at least have the decency to hide it in the likes so that you gotta dig for it.
Right, like he liked a bad post or something. Or maybe, Patrick Klepek, earlier on when he's posting on Reddit or whatever, he had a bad day. He was grumpy. He was grouchy that day, and he made a post. He's not. I mean, he's definitely still grouchy. Like, he's definitely still acting very childlike. But he now clearly has his wits about him. Here is one of the several Instagram stories he reposted. He reposted somebody else. So somebody else wrote this on their stories, and then he reposted it. Just want to send love to Nick Pizzolatto. I can only imagine how it feels to have all his classic dialogue butchered and misappropriated like it was last night on the season finale. And the interview where Issa Lopez, says they exist in the same universe. No, they do not. Last night's finale was some of the sloppiest writing I've ever watched. So insulting to call it True Detective, and beyond disrespectful to invoke the phrase "time is a flat circle." End quote. Anyway, this goes on for a whole other page of stuff. But yes, he is not handling this well, Patrick Klepek. He's not handling this well. It is a terrible, cringy look. Any thoughts on this whole situation, the discourse around True Detective, before we actually get to what happened in the finale?
Yeah, on one hand, I believe early on, especially with the way folks were, you know, going on places like Rotten Tomatoes, it was very easy to hand wave a lot of the most toxic criticism of the show as coming from very, you know, ugly corners of the internet that were upset over two, you know, women leads, you know, a focus on indigenous people and cultures, and like, all right, they're like, they don't have their two manly men talking in their cars, and like, that's okay. I've seen this show before. I come from video games. I see this happen all the time. It's a very familiar story. But what's so odd about the arc of this show is exactly what you said earlier, which is it got this bandwagon effect. A lot more people started watching it that I think started watching it because other people were watching it. I could just notice this happening in my own online circles, just like casually scrolling through, you know, a Twitter or a Blue Sky. It's like more people, I can tell that more people are watching this. I could tell that more people were watching it. I couldn't tell if more people were enjoying it. I can't quite pinpoint what happened here. I can't like really unpack, like, you and I have been sending each other different like tweets or like places from other social media. Like, there was somebody, not a TV critic, works for Vox.com. I don't need to name them. It doesn't matter. But like, I'm just mentioning them as like a notable publication. They're a notable figure. And like, this is the worst television show I've ever seen. And your response was exactly right. They need to watch some more fucking television because we're going to get into it. Like, a flawed show. Lots of legitimate criticisms to unpack and talk through and wonder about. But there's just something about this show that attracted so much disproportionate interest that I just can't. Maybe it's the same way the Super Bowl. We desire moments to talk about as a as a monoculture, and sometimes those happen in the biggest possible form, the Super Bowl, and then in smaller pockets. And the fact that HBO is one of the few places that remains committed to more or less the weekly drop allows people to, like, you can't join something to be interested in watching or even just to hate watch if it all drops at once. If 8 episodes drop at once, you have a moment to become involved, which is that first week, maybe the week after, before we move on to the next amorphous thing. When something's, only 6 episodes, you can jump in midstream, catch up on the 3, and like be part of that as it goes forward. And so I think there was a bit of a like train wreck, car crash, like choose your like metaphor. Like, people are like, why is everyone talking about this True Detective season? I think people got on board with that. And then sort of, depending on how they responded to it, a mixture of hate watching or genuine curiosity, it just became this, it became a cultural flashpoint. And when you and I saw the reviews for this, I would have not predicted really that this show was going to become a cultural flashpoint. Because I think the culture part is why it exploded. Because then it becomes finger pointing about misogyny or misandry and like toxic masculinity, like all this stuff, the stew, which are topics we hear all the time, you know, in woke adjacent topics that come up in various form of culture. Somehow this show became a flashpoint for that. And that's ultimately what I wasn't expecting. And I think help goes to explain the really exaggerated and vitriolic reactions to a show that I don't think deserves like this level of reaction from a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, the praise from critics was universal when the show, the embargo came up. And so I thought this is a show that everyone in the culture is going to celebrate. Like, everyone's going to love. And it's interesting to see how it's been received so drastically differently by different people who often have similar opinions about things. Yes. You know, different people who often are like, hey, Succession, great show. Like, everyone's like, this is an amazing show. And then, like, now those same people, some of them think this is freaking horrible, and some of them think that this True Detective Night Country is amazing. A couple of other things also helped, that obviously the return of Jodie Foster to like a major acting role, the return of True Detective, a series that many people thought might not exist anymore, and also the fact that there's a central mystery to the show that promised some kind of resolution, which we will discuss momentarily, in its final episode, right? And those things all converged, in addition to everything you said, I think, to make it so that, yeah, this was a thing that a lot of people talked about, a lot of people are interested in. And all that said, I think we can all agree that Nick Pizzolatto is not acquitting himself well in this situation. Would you say that's the case, Patrick?
No, he's seen chronically online in the worst possible ways. And the kind, it's one thing to be critical of a work that is, and I can understand having strong opinions about a season that it sounds like he had little to no involvement in from conception to release, that makes the choice to explicitly tie in very concretely to, like, in some very like big ways to a show that you were critical in crafting. I can understand having opinions, feelings, reactions to that, but what's happened, like, and I can almost not quite hand wave away, but like the liked comments, it's like, man, like, if you're sitting around at night and you're on your phone and someone says something that validates like a shitty feeling you're having, I can see it being so easy to just hit like, thank you. I can't publicly say that, but that is like this shitty thing that I'm feeling. And hitting like is just so easy to do. And there's a little heart animation that goes with it. Thank you. But what he's graduated to is outright celebrating, spreading misogyny, like just the worst parts of like essentially like alt-right, far-right culture wars, like that he's engaging with that now and celebrating the fact that those very same people like look to his work as validation for how they feel about being men, being in the culture. That's not great. Now it's a great route to make money and be popular, but it's not great. He seems to be doubling down in that direction. And I hope the takeaway from HBO, however, how much I might question ultimately their decision to slap True Detective on this show, has the right takeaway from how these two showrunners have acquitted themselves over the course of Night Country's airing.
I did appreciate Asia Romano's piece over at Vox.com, kind of taking a look back at the history of True Detective. You know, she wrote a piece called An Attempt to Reckon with True Detective Night Country's Bonkers Season Finale.
And great piece. Bonkers Season Finale betrays, I've written a lot of headlines, they're very hard, betrays like the deep subtlety in that piece. Like it's really, really worth reading.
She opens it by saying, to be a True Detective fan is to wrestle with uncomfortable contradictions. The first season is both a masterpiece of cosmic horror noir and a piece of art that feels like it was created not just by, but for men. It was a gritty treatise against toxic masculinity that still dehumanized women and ultimately reified the very thing it attempted to deconstruct, end quote. And I feel the same way. There's a lot of contradictions in that season of television. And many people think that Cary Joji Fukunaga is the person who made that season what it is, who, by the way, has reported, has stated that it was not easy to work with Nick Pizzolatto on it, you know, and that it wasn't a fair partnership.
That is, I believe, multiple folks who have worked on True Detective in numerous seasons have reported him to be a very difficult creative to work with.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's messy. And I just wanted to mention it because it's the stew in which the flavor of the final episode emerges from, you know. So those are some thoughts on the discourse and controversies around True Detective Night Country and the season finale. Patrick Klepek, let's talk about True Detective Night Country, the season finale, and our thoughts on it. Let's start with overall reaction, and then I'm going to go through a detailed spoiler-filled recap and kind of address many of the plot issues and threads that have come out of this thing. So what was your overall reaction to the True Detective Night Country season finale?
A finale I wanted to like, I wanted to love more than I actually did. I wanted to like more than I actually did. There are a lot of individual elements, and I think those will come up as we go through a moment by moment summary. But I find myself fairly disappointed by the end of all this, and not particularly happy with how the mystery box itself wrapped up.
Yeah. I feel the same way. You know, we just had a segment talking about the toxic discussion around the show. But I don't think what I'm about to say is toxic. I'll just say I thought
classic about to say something extremely toxic.
That's what someone who's about to say something toxic would say. But I thought this finale was pretty awful. I thought it was a pretty terrible episode of television. That has some cool elements to it, but the biggest issue with this episode is that it tries to do too much.
Yeah.
I think there's just too many ideas crammed into it that honestly make me baffled. Why did we spend all this time on other stuff earlier in the season when we could have kind of been seeding some of these ideas that they tried to cram into this episode? Yeah. Anyway. So overall, I thought everything felt super rushed. There's a bunch of hand wavy stuff that's just never really explained, and you know, it's up to you whether you find that satisfying or not. But I did not. I found it to be just extremely clunky and really stretched credulity. You know, just stuff that I just like is barely believable, in my opinion, in this episode. So overall, I was not a fan of how True Detective Night Country wrapped up. Let's talk about what actually happened. Spoiler-filled detailed recap begins now. Let's talk about Pryor's storyline, because Pryor has like four or five scenes in this episode, and they're kind of interspersed with everything else that happens. But let's just knock that out right now and just talk about what happens. So we see Pryor is forced to clean up Danvers' house, including his dad's dead body and Otis Heiss's body. As he's putting the finishing touches on the cleaning job, Danvers' daughter shows up and Pryor has to improvise. So he drives Leah to stay with his wife, Kayla, and Pryor and his wife reconcile. Pryor heads to Rose and asks her to take him to where Julia is. So they go out to the middle of the ice where they let Hank and Otis vanish into the depths of the water. And Rose has this kind of actually cool speech where she talks about how, like, you know, you might think you just did the hard thing now, but the hard part is what comes after forever. That's the worst fucking part, end quote, which I thought was actually a great line and very apt for the situation. Patrick Klepek, I'm just going to say the way that Pryor and Kayla's storyline resolved was rushed to the point of ridiculousness, I think. Like, she is really upset that Pryor is spending all this time on this case, which, like, as a listener has pointed out in the past of Decoding TV, like, hey, maybe show some understanding given that there's the biggest mass murder that has just occurred in this town in its history. Like, okay, but putting that aside, that's fine that she doesn't want to accept that because she's trying to raise a family and make a home or whatever. Who, you know, that's fine. But then for her to just suddenly be like, okay, I guess it's fine what Pryor is doing now with no explanation, it just made absolutely no sense to me. Patrick Klepek, any thoughts on how Pryor's storyline resolved?
Yeah, I mean, I think with the two of them, I always made some assumptions in my head that, yes, as horrible as this incident what happened with the scientists, and maybe you should give him some leeway, this wasn't the first time he's been Danvers' lapdog, and that this has been an ongoing problem that, hey, when you have a kid come into your life, find some way to balance and shift those priorities, hard as it may be. And that stuff just kind of comes to a head with this extraordinary moment in the town. That said, I would have far preferred the ambiguity of that relationship just never resolving itself in any meaningful way. I think that would have been more powerful to leave that unresolved between those two characters where we just don't know, he has killed his father. He has taken care of these bodies. What does that emotional weight do to a person? And to leave it there, even if there is a scene where we get some sort of sense that they're going to attempt at a reconciliation, I could imagine a montage at the end where you see or whatever. But like, I think there were better ways. I mean, this is actually an instance where I think in a finale where it provides a lot of answers. I think people's problems are going to be more about what the answers it provides than its lack of answers. This was one where I would have preferred some more ambiguity, or it would have required a much longer show. It would have required further episodes, like a whole episode that was an epilogue, like working through the wake of all the characters and the actions that happened over the course of the season. Because I'm with you, it very much felt like the show going, there's really no, like, I have these characters in the chess pieces here. This is the last time they can talk before they're not going to be near anywhere anymore.
Right.
And I would have preferred the show left us to sit with Pryor's, like, all that weight on his heart and what that could mean for his future. Because the way it chooses to, like, kind of wrap it in a bow feels very rushed and very unbelievable.
I would say laughable. Like, everyone basically gets a happy ending. Like, everyone kind of gets what they want in the show. And that is just ridiculous, given everything that's happened in the last five episodes, the tone of the last five episodes. Like, everyone just kind of, oh, it's all resolved. And that's the tone of the very last 10 minutes of this episode, I would argue.
Yes.
So anyway, Pryor's storyline comes to an end. He may or may not be haunted by needing to kill his dad. We don't really know.
And the last thing I'll say is Rose, the wildly underutilized character. I think this was a show that could have used her a lot more. Like, the couple of times she does appear, I wish we could have known more about this character, and they could have played a more important role in the season.
100%. The great Fiona Shaw, obviously, playing Rose. And but you know what I will say about Rose, Patrick Klepek, somebody who you can show up with a dead body in the middle of the night and she's gonna no questions asked help you dispose of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm. Okay, I was taking notes, David.
Yeah. I mean, how much negative can you say about a person like that? You know,
I got a sense that she also knows how to commit some Costco fraud. So, like, Rose, taking notes. Like, I know what's going on.
All right. Let's talk about what happens in the rest of the episode. We open on December 31st, the 14th day of night. Danvers and Navarro are entering the tunnel in search of whatever secrets the mining corporation's covering up. They go deeper and deeper into the mine, only to find Clark is there? What?
I want to point out, I want to make clear to the audience that David wrote, "What?" Like, in all caps with multiple question marks in a recap. I just want the "what" is a point of emphasis in the text.
I mean, when I first saw this, I was like, this is complete bullshit. Like, you know, like, when that was my reaction while watching it, right?
Maybe it's a ghost or a maybe it is some sort of extension of some of the supernatural. That was my initial impulse, was this is a some manifestation of whatever supernatural elements.
Well, it becomes clear very rapidly, like in 2 minutes, that that's not the case.
This
whole underground lab, an intricate lab in the ice, and then they discover, dun dun dun, they are actually directly underneath not only the original research facility from episode one, but also there is a massive fossilized creature in the ice above them.
In a spiral.
Danvers pokes around the lab and also finds tools that match the murder weapon. Okay. I mean, I think a lot of people, from what I've seen, a lot of people just jumped off the train right here. The idea that this is directly underneath the ice, because it would be one thing if there is a way to shoot this episode that makes this more believable, right? Like, they drive out to the middle of nowhere, they go into the ice, and then they spend 8 hours trekking through these intricate ice tunnels or whatever. And then arrive at this point where they're like, oh my gosh, we ended up under the Salal research station in that time. But it's like, the way the episode is shot and edited makes it feel like they got there almost immediately, like within 10 minutes, you know? And that's just like, well, why would they not know that they're directly under the station? That makes no sense. Well,
and we wasted, you know, for only a 6-episode show, like, enormous amounts of time, like, making it seem like we need to track down map makers am. Like, someone to guide us to these places.
We need to give this guy heroin.
Yeah.
So that he can point out where we need to go. It's fucking directly underneath where you were.
You have to go, like, interrupt the marriage of one of Danvers' old fuck buddies, like, in order to get him to point something. Like, we travel out to a collapsed entrance. And it's like, oh, this is must be like a really intricate, sprawling part of this. Like, the geography doesn't make a lot of sense. And it ultimately makes it, like, it makes a lot of the plotting of the show as a whole feel very thin if over 6 episodes we discover by the time we get into answer territory that actually a very short amount of time was also being spent, like, wasting time, which doesn't feel, I think, makes the answers, however they settle with you, feel even less empty, or even more empty, rather.
You know, if I'm interpreting this charitably, Patrick Klepek, I'm reminded of the words of T.S. Eliot, quote, "We shall not cease from exploration, and at the end of all of our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." End quote.
I mean, isn't it how the show opens? So, yeah, like, you're not wrong.
Anyway, Danvers pokes around the lab and finds tools that match the star-shaped pattern of the murder weapon. That's going to be really important throughout the course of the episode.
Multiple characters are going to grab this weapon and immediately have a realization about it in a way that feels very unrealistic.
And leap to one of the most drastic conclusions possible. Okay. So anyway, Clark traps Liz inside a room in the facility. So they go upwards into the research facility. There is a cool moment when they get to the top of the facility and you're like, oh, they were underneath it the whole time. And that moment of, like, wow lasted for about 0.5 seconds before I realized how silly this whole development was. Anyway, Clark traps Liz inside a room in the facility and uses a fire extinguisher to knock Navarro on the head. Danvers gets free and finds Navarro has come to and is pummeling Clark. Danvers and Navarro then immediately start torturing Clark by playing video of Annie's death on a loop and taping it headphones into Clark's ears. So many things in this whole thing that I just are so ridiculous. First of all, people on this show, the two women on the show are just fucking invincible. Like, they, like, Navarro, Navarro got the shit beat out of her a couple episodes ago and then shows up the next morning at Denver's house looking completely fine.
It feels like this show takes place over the course of a week, right? At most. So the gap between her getting the shit kicked out of her and Danvers having a diabolical hangover is, like, I don't know, 36 hours at most between events.
But then Navarro gets fucking knocked in the head with, like, and the way it's filmed, it looks like that's all she wrote for Navarro. Like, it looks like it's over for Navarro. Like, she's not getting up again from this. And then the next scene, she's beating the shit out of Clark. It's just, I am baffled at these, there's a way to do these plot points in a way that feels believable, right? Mm-hmm. Like I said, show Navarro and Danvers trekking through the ice for hours and hours and hours. Show Navarro just getting lightly grazed by the fire extinguisher. But every time the show chooses this extremely kind of drastic thing that just makes no sense in the physical world, in my opinion. And then
Danvers doesn't even, you know, it seemed like they were setting up for Danvers to be the one who's rescuing. Yes. And yes. It's like, cool. Like, she just, it was actually cool as shit how she, like, took out that glass. Like, yeah, I enjoyed that sequence. Yes. Like, all right, let her have the heroic moment. This is somebody that doesn't have a lot going for them right now. Let them have it. And the show's like, no.
Yeah.
She got smashed in the back of the head with the second concussion she's had this week alone. I mean, they're treating her like she's a football player. Like, get back out there, Tiger. Right. Like, you pass protocol. And it's a really unsatisfying resolution for a sequence that could have, like, had way more pop to it for one character, and specifically Danvers.
Absolutely bizarre creative decisions, in my opinion. Okay, but anyway, and it's even more bizarre when they just start fucking torturing this guy, like, right out the gate. Like, no, they didn't even ask him.
It's been a long week, David. I mean, gotta get him out somehow.
They did not even freaking ask him any questions, Patrick Klepek. They just went straight to the torture. I'm just like, okay, like, Wow, that's a lot. You're assuming a lot. Now, it turns out that their assumptions are correct, that he is a piece of shit. But, wow, that's assuming a lot. Okay, wow, that's assuming a lot. All right, anyway. After torturing him for a while, Clark starts to answer their questions. Okay, and I'm just going to say, the whole thing fucking sucks. A, that they went straight to the torture. B, that apparently the torture is effective. That's just terrible. Terrible depiction of torture. I have a problem with that. And anyway, okay, moving on. Clark explains that they were digging for DNA in the permafrost that could potentially save the world. And the pollution from the mine helped to soften the permafrost and allow them to extract the DNA much faster. So it wasn't that they were covering up the pollution. In fact, quote, we were pushing the mine to produce more pollutants. The more waste in the water, the more waste in the ground, the better the permafrost was for our work, end quote. So anyway, Annie discovers the work they're doing and then starts destroying it. And the miners discover this, and one of them, Lund, starts straight up stabbing her to death. We then see that Clark describes everyone as helping to finish the job. I would never hurt her, he says, but in flashback, we see that he's the one that actually delivers the coup de grace. Let's stop there for a moment. This is one of the core mysteries of the show is solved, right? It's the scientist that killed Annie after she discovered their work and was destroying it all. I don't know how I felt about this as a satisfying explanation. And the biggest problem is we don't know any of the scientists. We don't meet any of the scientists. We don't get to know any of them. It would be interesting, I think, if we got to know them and then you realize, actually, this nice guy is capable of murder if something mm-hmm. happens, basically, Patrick Klepek, there's just a lot of that escalated quickly in this episode. They just started straight up torturing Clark. Boy, that escalated quickly. They discover Annie torching their work, and their first reaction is to murder her, you know? How did you feel about the fact that the scientists are the ones that murdered Annie?
Well, even just piggybacking off that, there's an escalation in stakes of what their research is. The implication of what they're doing in this facility, it's not just what they're doing is awful, right? But it's not like mustache twirling, there's oil underneath this ice. They could save millions of lives right. if they went about this in a slightly more ethical fashion. I'm not trying to defend the actions of the scientists polluting and causing stillbirths, but did the show have to choose that as its MacGuffin for the scientists was the one of the most important scientific discoveries in the history of mankind?
It's up there with
transformative to health. It just feels like if you wanted me to hate them, make it something a little easier to grasp onto than this will literally change life as we know it forever. And so that part didn't land with me particularly well.
Well, I think the show, to its credit, right? I think the show is trying to. There is this tension between modernity and progress and mm-hmm. preserving our way of life or preserving, the things that we already have or preserving nature. Right. And this is a tension that the show has been throughout the season.
For sure.
But then as you indicate, escalates dramatically when it's save mankind from disease or pollute a little bit and pollute a little bit more,
I understand where it's hey, this has been an exploitative practice over millennia in which indigenous people are their resources are extracted from where they live, where they habitate, and then get none of the benefit, right? It's it's not as though it's an equal opportunity partnership. And if the show wants to make the argument that, hey, we're going to extract all this and this is just going to go to some rich motherfuckers and they won't have cancer anymore, but it's not going to the people in this town. I can sit here and intellectually understand how we get to there. I just don't think the show does a good job of getting you to feel as though that is a really strong point that the show is making.
I think the show wants to play in shades of gray, more and be like, hey, actually maybe the scientists aren't bad because they're trying to save humanity, but they're willing to kill this woman, you know, like, and it's like, okay, yeah, I guess. But the problem is you don't know the scientists. You don't know any of them.
Yep.
You don't give a shit about any of them. So the fact that they all turned out to be murderers is like, all right, I get fine. I didn't know that maybe they were all terrible people. Who knows? You know, but yes, thematically, it makes sense to some degree from a storytelling perspective.
It just didn't land for me.
It's not particularly satisfying. Yeah. So,
yeah.
I did appreciate that Clark is narrating a different version of the story that actually happens. And that's one of the more artful parts of the episode is you have, and the show, is you have multiple times where people are telling a story and then they show what actually happened and it's very different.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. It's like it kind of draws this contrast between the stories we tell and what actually happened.
Well, especially because some of the most powerful moments that occur in this sequence are like him repeatedly saying, I loved her. I wouldn't hurt her. And like contrasting that against the violence that is being perpetrated against her, I thought was probably some of the strongest stuff that happens in this episode. And it was like grounded in character and like really clever and smart editing as opposed to, you know, a lot of the other stuff that happens.
Agreed. So anyway, Clark, when danger arrives at the Salal facility, Clark flees and we see in a flashback, Clark flees and goes down the hatch, but he doesn't know what happened afterward. He doesn't know what happens to scientists. So then there's this weird scene where it seems like Navarro is about to murder Clark, but then she doesn't. And then Danvers reveals that she would have killed. Danvers and Navarro have a moment together where Danvers revealed she would have killed Wheeler if Navarro hadn't. We then flash back to the moment where Wheeler is executed by Navarro, and then a baby's cry rings out. Now, I have read online about like what's up with this baby's cry, and I don't think there's any resolution for it. Like, we don't, you know, some people were speculating maybe Danvers adopted this baby and that's who Holden is, but that doesn't really line up with the timeline or anything else we've been told in the show. I think that the baby's cry is just to show you that there's consequences for Navarro's actions that she might not have anticipated before she does something like executing this guy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you had any interpretation of what the baby was there, but you know, that's the best I can come up with, basically.
Yeah, and I will say my immediate reaction was, oh, I guess that's her daughter. I guess she adopted her. But you're right that, like, her daughter's in high school. So, like, I guess we don't get a sense of how far, like, how long ago the Wheeler incident was.
But I don't think it was fucking 15 years ago.
I don't think it was
ago.
17 years ago yeah, or whatever. Yeah, yeah, like, that's, yeah. that's, yeah. Like, I could buy a decade ago, but I can't buy, you know, a kid on the verge of going to college, so... But that I will admit that was my immediate reaction I guess that's where she got her daughter, especially given, you know, some of what we learn about later in regards to Danvers.
Yeah. Here are some other theories I'm reading here from epicstream.com. So the idea that the baby could have been Leah doesn't quite fit, considering that Liz lost Holden and her husband in a tragic car accident when Leah was already a teen. That's made clear in the show. Another theory is that Danvers didn't actually hear a baby crying, but may have experienced a flashback to her own son because of the song Wheeler had been whistling. And another theory suggests that the baby's crying was only a figment of Trooper Navarro's imagination, end quote. So those are all, you know, plausible theories, but the idea that, like, it's her son or it's her daughter doesn't really line up with the timeline. But maybe Navarro, it was a figment of Navarro's imagination. Maybe it was a figment of Danvers' imagination, but like, doesn't seem like it was actually a baby that played a role in the plot. So
gotcha.
I wanted to address that, but yeah, if you feel differently or think differently, decodingtv@gmail.com, let us know. All right. So the two of them try to extract more info from Clark, but his mind is toast and he longs for the sweet release of death. So Navarro lets Clark go outside where he freezes to death in the same manner as his colleagues. The power goes out and the two try to bring the power back, and Navarro sees a ghostly version of Clark hyperventilating. Danvers and Navarro create a fire, and Navarro reveals that there's something out there calling to me. There's so much more to this, Liz. There's so much more to this. Navarro says Holden is out there and Liz reacts poorly. Navarro has visions and then goes out into the snow. Navarro learns her indigenous name is in a vision. And I believe I'm going to try to pronounce it correctly. Sukanyakyuk, I believe, is how it's pronounced, or something along those lines, which means, we later learn, the return of the sun after the long darkness. I'm just going to pause here for a moment. I think the Navarro and her getting in touch with her indigenous roots is like a complete... it is not given sufficient time in this season. I think it feels like an afterthought, and I'm disappointed with how this season dealt with that subplot, because I can imagine it being really interesting, but I don't think what we saw in this season made it so. Anyway.
I fully agree with you. It feels like something that would have required most of the A plot. Like, it would have had to been essentially a thread that is followed from start to finish with the entirety of the season, not shared, like not shared with a Danvers, and ultimately ends up feeling as though it's a, here's a character. We got to give them a motivation alongside this season. And it didn't land with me, especially given how sensitive the subject matter is and its implications for like what's going on and how Navarro has been acting. I mean, we'll get into some of this later. I found it profoundly frustrating, if not at times outright insulting, but we can get into why I feel that way with some of what Navarro does later.
Danvers falls through the ice and hears her son's her dead son's voice. She's about to die when suddenly Navarro comes back and pulls her out of the ice, and then she reveals that Holden, Navarro has seen Holden speaking to her and has told her, like, he sees you, Danvers. The whole thing is ridiculous, Patrick Levitt. Not the Holden part, but like falling through the ice, and then Navarro comes back just
She's
in the
dead.
Nick of time.
Fucking Danvers, donezo. Bye. Later. You watch some like what the amount of time it took Clark to die. It is suggested, minutes,
right?
To go out into this cold and to perish. The idea that she fell in freezing cold water a quarter mile from.
Right.
Like, safety.
Navarro is just out there, and then she's like, wait, Liz is in trouble, comes back, pulls her. It's just, we've reached the part of the episode where just stuff is happening because the script says it has to happen, right? Like, it's just random shit's happening, and so on. Okay, so the storm ends, and Liz and Danvers connect for a bit before Navarro says the phrase, holding the hatch, and Liz has an extremely cliche detective moment where she says, wait, what did you say? No, before that. So they realize that one of the women, Blair Hartman, was there at the Salal facility because she leaves a very distinct handprint on the hatch above Clark because she's missing two fingers. Now, how Liz came to this conclusion, whatever, you know, and then they spray it and it's like, oh, good thing Blair Hartman just happened to touch the hatch in that way that made it extremely clear she's missing two fingers. Otherwise, they would have been completely screwed. But they go to visit her and one of the women, B, who's clearly the group's leader, starts describing what actually happened at the Salal facility. We have another flashback, like I think the third or fourth this episode, when this whole pack of women discovers how Annie K was killed. We see like they all know each other. They all like talk to each other. One of them is mopping the floor and water goes into this hatch. And then so they go down under and they discover the star-shaped murder weapon. So they're like, these dudes must have murdered her. That's the only conclusion that we can come to from this information. And so in a separate, these are the women who know everything, by the way, and they've discovered how Annie K was killed. The women who know everything is a phrase that Issa Lopez used to describe them. So in another flashback, the women storm the Salal facility and drive the men out into the middle of nowhere and set them free. However, as the woman, as B describes the story, she describes how they woke Annie up and Annie is the one who got revenge on the men. Quote, I guess she ate their dreams from the inside out, spit out their frozen bones. But, you know, it's just a story, end quote. But they seize these men. They rush them out into the middle of nowhere and then sent them out into the ice. And I guess they kind of clawed their eyes out or whatever they did before they froze to death. That is the resolution. Now, I'm just going to say, I love the idea of these women getting vigilante justice on these guys who murdered Annie. In concept, it's a cool idea. In concept, it's acknowledging that the justice system does not deal well with the fates of indigenous women very often in our history. And that is something that is worth highlighting and worth giving attention to. But the way in which it happens, I think, is just really pretty silly and clunky for the reasons we've already discussed. Patrick Klepek, how did you feel about how the central mystery of the season was solved?
In the moment, I found that sequence of like showcasing what happened to all these men in the facility, like really thrilling. I think it's shot really well. It's like a mixture of incredibly tense and also profoundly funny. I think it has like a really extraordinary tone. And found myself very swept up in, this is an interesting answer to what happened here. My problem is it very much feels as though this idea is what the whole season hinges on. And then everything worked backwards from how do we arrive here? And it doesn't feel natural. It doesn't feel earned. It feels, like you said, clunky. And so if you would just show that sequence to somebody and like broadly describe what happened in the show, I think someone would go, holy shit. Like that's how this show is operating. And I just don't think.
Right. The show rips. It goes hard, you know? Yeah.
It's a different show. Like, I don't think the show, that sequence does rip, but it doesn't land it's not in the right show. The show doesn't earn that moment. I think it's a different show that arrives at that. And so I really, really enjoyed that sequence, but did not find it satisfying as a puzzle piece for the whole tapestry of the season, I guess, is where I landed on it.
I think I feel the same way. Because just the idea that they could piece it together, and then also, by the way, all of the men are responsible, right? Like, not just one dude, like, all of the men need to be killed. It's like, okay.
I kind of loved that part. I was like, fuck it. Like, you know what? You're just you're a stand-in for all the other assholes that have come through this area. Sorry, you were here. That didn't bother me in so much as it just, again, like I feel like the way it slots in to this, weirdly, despite the show being trying to really centralize indigenous cultures and plights, like it feels very, it still doesn't feel very central to what is actually happening in this show. And then what ends up happening with the sequence is that the true feelings of these indigenous people become a MacGuffin. Like, it becomes a clever aha for the end of a season, as opposed to like the central thrust. I don't feel like, even though we get like the protests and stuff like that, it's all kind of just off to the side. It just sort of fills in the broader world of the show, as opposed to being like a thesis statement or like a central motivating factor. And I think that drove some of my frustration with this appearance kind of out of nowhere towards the end.
Well, let's extrapolate what the central theses are of the show, right? I mean, scientists are evil. they are murderous people that wish to pollute the planet, here's the thing. Some scientists actually are, you know, there are scientists that work for oil companies and so on. So like,
sure.
It's not like all scientists are good, but like this show chooses to highlight those ones that are bad. And also, killing is okay, whether cops are doing it or vigilante groups are doing it. It's everything is forgiven at the end because the ends justifies the means. That's kind of to the extent that the show has any messages, I think those are the messages or adjacent to them.
Also, no real consequences.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, no,
nobody. Seems like the oil company is gonna, you know, like everyone.
Well, actually, no. We'll address that in a bit, but. But certainly for the people who are doing the killing, you know, like nothing bad needs to happen to any of them, whether they're cops or the indigenous people. Killing is fine as long as you're doing it for the right reasons. That's kind of how I think the show ends. It certainly doesn't end with anyone being tormented about any of that stuff. Any of the people that have been killed, other than maybe Wheeler for like a second. So yeah, not super thrilled with the way that this ended. But yeah, as you said, really cool sequence. The music, the way it's shot and edited, really, really thrilling stuff. But It comes out of nowhere, in my opinion, and we just don't know enough about these women or the scientists for this to be particularly satisfying, in my opinion. So, all right. There's an epilogue. We cut to May 12th, several months later. And True Detective Season 1, Danvers is being interrogated by two dudes and provides a clean story of the a clean version of the story to investigators that exonerates all of our main characters, including Pryor, who is still there and working with her and not in, you know, not drugged out in some hotel having hit rock bottom because of, he's racked with guilt over his father's death. Clark, by the way, has recorded a confessional video that was leaked and publicly viewed and gotten the mine shut down. So I have zero follow-up questions, Patrick Lepik, to that happening. Because we all know that in modern society, when you leak a video of a bad thing happening, the bad thing gets shut down within months. And there are no massive institutional forces that are part of entrenched powers that seek to keep the status quo going at all. So I have the follow-up questions.
Danvers, and you know, for as bad as it was, I know we could save so many people, and maybe there'd be like a different way of extracting this stuff. Let's just let it go.
Let's just let it go.
I think we're good.
There's no way.
We'll find some dinosaur bones somewhere else. Don't worry about it.
There's no other way of softening that permafrost than through polluting.
We could patent something that literally we would make trillions of dollars on for eternity. Nah, I think we should put up a for sale sign in front of that facility.
Put up a do not go here sign. No trespassing on that one.
Come on.
Danvers and her daughter, by the way, are getting along just fine now. So, like, the events of the season have made it so that Danvers has learned her lesson, I guess.
See, like, that's like, that's the flip of like Pryor's relationship getting resolved, like, in a very flip way.
Right.
Having those two, that needed, like, you need to show... This is a show not tell moment. You need to Danvers never has a moment with her daughter where she like really reckons with herself. And yeah,
It's outrageous. It's outrageous. There's this moment where Danvers' daughter calls her and says, "Hey, mom, come home, okay?" Which is like a very normal thing to say, even for a parent you hate. But then, yeah, to then be like, "Oh, and things are fine now," because we see them in the car and they're laughing and. I don't know. Maybe the rest of the time they're unhappy, but it's certainly, I think the impression that the show tries to lead us with is Danvers learned how to be a decent mom after this, I guess, whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then Navarro has escaped and is presumably walking out into the tundra of nothingness. But in the final shot, we see what appears to be Navarro hanging out with Liz. So walking out into inhospitable, icy conditions, good, actually. Something that we should romanticize and celebrate, Patrick Lepik. Now, people have speculated that that's not actually Navarro. That's an imagined version of Navarro or a ghostly apparition of Navarro. I don't think we need to spend time talking about that unless you have an opinion on this, Patrick Lepik, but I wanted to bring up that people think that might not actually be Navarro at the end. It could be a ghost.
I think that's a fair reading based on how the show outlines itself. But something I'm curious what you make of. We were talking about what is the thesis of the show? What is it saying? What do you think the show is saying about mental illness, which is a core storyline for one of the sub characters? Is our takeaway from this show supposed to be that mental illness that Navarro, her sister is experiencing is a manifestation of a connection to like spirits of the land around them, and that to listen to them and then die is an honorable thing to do? Like, I don't know what this show is trying to say about mental illness and people who struggle with mental illness. And I find it like messy in the most charitable interpretation and like deeply problematic, like in the least charitable explanation.
I think I would say the show really wants to leave a lot of things open to interpretation, in which that is one of them, you know. And that I remember there's this Prime Video animated series called Unbound that I thought was really interesting, or Undone, I should say, that's really interesting. And that's like back in the day, you know, hundreds or thousands of years ago, people in our society that thought they could commune with spirits or talk to God were given places of great honor in our society. And today we call them, many of them, schizophrenics, you know, or have some other unsavory or unfortunate label for them. And I, you know, if the show was trying to make a point about that, about how like communing with the spirits is not actually a sign of mental illness or whatever, I don't think the show did a particularly good job of landing that.
No.
But I think that what is in the show allows for that, and allows for any multitude of interpretations. One of which is that it's highly problematic. And another of which is, hey, that we do exist among things that we cannot understand or explain. And sometimes people listen to those voices, and that is okay. You know, like
I agree. That's what the show is trying to say, but in reality, I don't really buy it. I don't think it lands it. And it mostly uses an excuse for a bunch of cheap jump scares that got less interesting as the show went along. And so I found that part pretty frustrating.
That's completely fair. There are a lot of unanswered questions in the finale. One of them is what was going on with the baby. Another one is what happened with the tongue.
Mm.
They mentioned the tongue multiple times. You know, they ask Clark, well, what was up with the tongue? He's like, I didn't do that. They ask the woman, hey, so why'd you leave the tongue there? And they're like, that's not part of the story. Like, what are you talking about? We didn't do the tongue. And Issa Lopez has addressed the tongue and said, hey, it was important for Issa Lopez to not answer all the questions and to leave there some mystery out there. And I actually respect that as an approach, right? But yeah, there's she lists some of the possibilities. Like we know that Hank was sent to the mine to hide or dispose of Annie's body. And it's very possible he cut the tongue off and left the tongue there to make some kind of, leave the tongue there, you know. But then it's like, okay, well, what happens when he cuts the tongue off and leaves it there with Annie's body? Maybe the woman, I'll just read. The woman who knew everything knew that they couldn't take care of Annie's body in the way they would like to. So one of them keeps the tongue as an act of reverence and kindness to the body that is going to go through a lot of indignities. They preserve the tongue. Danvers says in episode 2 that the tongue has some unusual damage, which could be because of freezing. And then when the woman comes to the station, they leave the tongue as a sign that now is the time of truth of our storytelling. The stories that Annie couldn't tell and was silenced for are going to come to light. Another version of events is Annie's left there and the tongue is cut and the tongue disappears into thin air. And it is Annie who comes back with the woman into the station. Clark says, I knew she was coming. And Annie does visit, the ghost of Annie does visit the station with the woman. And she leaves her own tongue because she knows this is how it starts. And she can finally tell the story. So it is up to you to decide, end quote. It's either ghost Annie somehow leaving her physical tongue there, or I actually think the first version is much more plausible, which is Hank cut the tongue off, or the woman cut the tongue off and preserved it as a sign of respect and then left the tongue there symbolically, you know. So but it's important to her that you choose your own interpretation. So I wanted to acknowledge the matter of the tongue. Any other thoughts on the season finale of True Detective: Night Country, Patrick Klepek? I feel like I have set you up to be very negative on this finale.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am very negative on the finale. Were there any parts of this show or this finale that you particularly enjoyed, or that we should acknowledge before we wrap things up for the rest of the season? I do also want to point out, if people have emails or thoughts on the show and they want to send it to us, decodingtv@gmail.com. If we get enough emails, we will address them on a future episode of the podcast. But Patrick Klepek, any closing thoughts on this episode?
Yeah, I mean, look, I am pretty down on how it wrapped up, but I think ultimately still enjoyed the show. I almost said really enjoyed the show. I think I cooled on it, especially with where things sort of ended up. I think how I ended up feeling about the show and the episode as a whole is something that I mentioned earlier. I still think it was a critical failure to attach the True Detective stuff to this show. It might be responsible for so many more people seeing it, but the time is a flat circle, the spiral stuff, I found it painful,
forced, cringy.
Added absolutely nothing and substantively took away from what was here. And I would be so much more, I'm not saying it would be a perfect show, but would have been so much more, if it wasn't going to be a movie, like kind of how it was pitched, and then it kind of turned into a TV, like kind of a television show. My guess is the version of this that is not True Detective up is a better show. I don't think it's perfect. I think if you were to take all the structural stuff and keep it the same, it would still have problems. But I think that contributed to the cultural toxicity. I think it created all sorts of tensions within the show itself. And I just don't know what it added other than a branding and marketing exercise that serves the show and what it does do well poorly. And so I'll be curious, like, how I feel on the show, like how we feel about the show with some distance, because I think it's difficult for how this show created a certain kind of reaction. And because of those ties to the first season and how that first season is now, despite feeling like it came out yesterday, is now nostalgia, where this show ultimately ends up landing. My guess is I feel better about it with time, but I do think this final episode leaves a poor taste in my mouth because many of the things I was rooting for, like, didn't pan out in the ways I was hoping. I will say, to the show's credit, it was a mystery box show and it provided answers. I think the answers it provides, you can quibble with, you can be really upset with. But the stuff that's ambiguous, the stuff that is left unanswered, like the tongue, what happens to Danvers at the end, like those are
Navarro.
It answers the core mysteries that it sets out at the beginning. And I realize that's some low hanging fruit. But it does provide a resolution. And then it's just a matter of how do you feel about those component pieces and where they all end up. And that's not always the case with mystery box shows. They don't always necessarily provide you with even the basic answers of what happens at the end, and has more of a concrete resolution than season one of True Detective did. Whether you feel that's the approach that should have taken or not is, you know, another matter entirely. But that's kind of where I ended up.
Yeah, I have a couple more thoughts. But before we do that, Patrick Klepek, why don't you share where people can find more of your work on the internet this week?
Yeah, you can follow all my talk about video games and sports and things of that over at remapradio.com. And then I run a newsletter called Crossplay about parenting and gaming at crossplay.news, where I just launched a new podcast called Spawn Point, where me and Keza McDonald over at The Guardian talk about being kind of modern day parents and caretakers in the age of video games. So please give that a listen if you got a chance.
Very cool. All right, I'll share a couple closing thoughts on True Detective Night Country. And I think I really appreciate a lot of what the show was trying to do. Like, the themes that the show has brought up, I think, are really important. The rape of the earth by corporations, the treatment of indigenous women by our legal system and by police, extrajudicial justice, you know, like all these things I think are actually like great topics. What small town life in a place where it's always dark, how that can affect the psyche and how important it is to forge bonds of community in situations like that. And, you know, there is a loneliness epidemic in the United States, and I think this show kind of gets towards that with its setting. I will say this, regardless of anything, any negative things I have to say about the show consistently looked excellent. And that's remarkable for a show that takes place almost entirely at night. We have seen TV shows like Game of Thrones or other shows where the show takes place at night and it looks like complete mud you can't make out one thing from the other. And this show never felt like that. And the show is an exemplary True Detective Night Country shows how you can light things that happen at night. You know, it doesn't always need to be blacks and dark blues, that you can have interesting lighting and silhouettes and different color temperatures and so on for something that takes place at night, and everything can be intelligible and you can understand it. And I think more shows that take place at night need to take a lesson from this show. So the show consistently looked excellent. No complaints about what True Detective's aesthetics were. But the unfortunate thing about this show is it had a ton of potential. It had an amazing cast. It had a really talented director. And then I think it just got too caught up in the plot machinations. I think also there were like at least two major reveals in the final episode. And that felt like just a lot to drop on the audience. And it felt like I'm just curious why they didn't stretch it out more. Like, why didn't they could have had the Clark reveal like significantly earlier on, mm-hmm. and then had some more character development, and then figured out like who actually murdered all the guys. I don't know why they chose to compress it all into one episode. It feels like a bizarre decision, but it makes the storytelling feel super rushed and clunky and ultimately unsatisfying. So at the end of the day, I didn't like this season of television, but it had a lot of good things going for it. And I do think that the discourse around it is really interesting. Like, I'm just, what a weird thing. What a weird way that all played out. Huh, Patrick Klepek?
Just a strange cultural flashpoint. Not the show I would have counted on that happening too.
Well, thanks so much for listening to our coverage of the show, and we'd love to hear what your thoughts are on this finale. DecodingTV@gmail.com is how you can get in touch with us. And until next time, we will see you here next week, a little bit later than usual, for our conversation about Constellation and Shogun. See you soon. Thanks. Goodbye.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.